to the wish.
Patty Griffin playing at the Troy Music Hall on November 12th at 7:30. TroyMusicHall.org. TroyMusicHall.org. And you can find out more about that event by going to their website. You can also see the entire playlist on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. Let me introduce the group to you, and then we'll get started. We've got a lot going on, a lot to talk about, and we are very excited. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning. I'm just ducky, but I did want to...
Quack.
But I did want to... Just to remind everybody, we have a very special program tomorrow, don't we, Joe?
That's right, Malcolm Nance. If you were one of the lucky people who got in for the Malcolm Nance event, Malcolm Nance will be our guest tomorrow and our sole panelist. Is it a panel and you only have one?
No.
Okay. Well, Alan and I will be there. Well, that sort of a faux panel.
Faux panel. Yeah.
Yeah. So it'll be Malcolm Nance. He has a brand new book out, The Plot to Betray America, and he will be the book comes out on Tuesday, but the launch party will be at the Linda tomorrow morning, and we are very excited to have that. They'll be from our normal time, 9 to 10:30. But if you have tickets, don't forget, you want to get in around, doors open at 8:15, 8:30-ish. We'll have breakfast, we'll meet, we'll greet, we'll do all that good stuff, and then book signing to follow. So that'll be the plan for tomorrow. Alan and I will be hosting. Malcolm will be talking. It'll be a good morning. All right. Thank you, Alan.
I bet Alan.
Alan
will talk, too.
I don't talk much, as you know.
I get to run around and have people ask questions. So
yeah.
We all have our roles.
You're the Joe Donahue role.
Vera Karius-Kelly is here, Siena College professor of comparative politics. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. How about everybody else?
Wonderful. Very
good.
Nice to have you here. Investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo is here. Good morning.
Hello.
Would you like to introduce our special guest?
No, I want you to.
Okay.
You're much more impressive.
Jim Heaney is the... Is it Heaney or Haney?
Heaney.
Heaney.
Jim Heaney. Meaning.
Yeah. I don't believe that.
Which he have to do in his job.
Fight back.
He is the founding.
I take it as a compliment.
He is the founding editor and executive director of Investigative Post. What is Investigative Post?
We're a nonprofit investigative reporting center based in Buffalo. We do work for our website, investigativepost.org, as well as WGRZ, which is the NBC affiliate for Buffalo, WBFO, the NPR affiliate. And Capitol Press Room.
Now, let me ask you a question, because the headline this morning was that the City Hall of Buffalo got raided.
Yeah. It's uncertain what exactly they're looking for.
This is the FBI raided them.
Yeah. You know, those raids happen periodically.
Only in Buffalo?
In Buffalo?
I mean, whatever. I mean,
no, he's right. They do. They happen here in Albany also. Right. And sometimes there's a follow-up, and you hear afterwards what it was all about. And sometimes you never hear.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody yesterday. They were really, really excited about this. And I said, you know, going back to the time I was a reporter at the Buffalo News previously, you know, every, like, so often there's a big raid by the FBI of City Hall, and everybody gets in a lather, and then nothing ever comes of it. So yeah. let's see.
Wait and see.
All right.
Can I just say the reason we have Jim here from Buffalo is because he's here to pick up a really prestigious award, the Nellie Bly Award. It's just the third year they've given it out from the Museum of Political Corruption and University of Albany, and it goes to the journalists who have done really spectacular work against all odds in the tradition of Nellie
Bly.
And
I'm not sure why I got it, you know?
Well, yes, we're sure, Jim. I used to be the head of a group called Investigative Reporters and Editors, and I always wondered, what this guy out in Buffalo, how the hell did he come along? Because he would break these huge stories. It's the best of the tradition of investigative reporters, just dogged work, getting people to talk and getting records to tell the story where people won't fill in, and that's what he does.
Now, the big story, when I got to know you and your work, was from the Buffalo Billions and the Caleros and Prococo and all that.
Mm-hmm.
That was you worked very, very hard on that story.
Yeah, and you know, it started out a story about lack of transparency by state government, and it morphed into something a lot larger, because, you know, where people are trying to hide something, there's usually something they're trying to hide.
And people went to jail as a result of that.
People, yeah. most of them are still out on appeal, but yeah, Caleros is still out on appeal. But I tell you, I've been a reporter a long time, and I've never dealt with stonewalling the way I did in that particular story. Hmm. Just the sheer brazenness and arrogance of the people in the Cuomo administration who I was dealing with was just, mind-boggling.
Do you think that the follow-up being that the you see a difference that the Cuomo administration has learned a lesson in that?
No.
You don't? I'm fascinated by that. How
no,
so?
No. We broke a story a couple weeks ago. There is a move afoot to provide state subsidies to a couple of projects in upstate to subsidize data centers, construction of data centers. Data centers typically require huge public subsidies, create few jobs, no spinoff development. The state is negotiating with a company whose government affairs staff includes the governor's former secretary and chairman of his campaign a committee from 2 years ago.
And that's bad, right?
I actually wrote a couple weeks ago, you know, it looks like Cuomo has not learned anything. At a minimum, the optics are terrible.
Yeah, well,
And it's probably, it may very well be more than just bad optics.
Well, maybe what he's learned, I'm sorry, Jim, is that you can do whatever you want, and you'll be overwhelmingly reelected as governor.
Yeah. I mean, you know, economic development under this governor is really about garnering headlines and giving the appearance of doing something without really doing anything other than spending a lot of public dollars on mega deals that really don't pan out. I mean, the major Buffalo Billion project, which is construction of the Tesla plant to build solar panels, is not panning out. They put more money into a building to accommodate IBM downtown. That's not panning out. It's been one very expensive disappointment after another.
As far as the economic development, I know there's differences between the cities. I mean, but you look at Albany, you look at Buffalo. I mean, we're the state capital. You have a football team. But when you take away, they're very similar upstate cities, right?
Buffalo's actually quite a bit bigger.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it's bigger, mm-hmm. but I mean, it's
snowier.
But I'm talking about
closer to Ohio.
But I'm talking about economic development as far as the same issues that plague upstate of jobs and creation of it's the reason why they want to do a Buffalo Billions project.
Well, I think it was to burnish Cuomo's credentials. One thing to keep in mind with any of these big deals. So the Buffalo job market is about 570,000 people. And if everything they did with the Buffalo Billion pans out the way they say it would, you're talking 2,000-3,000 jobs. It's minuscule. These big projects do not move the needle. And they're not intended to. They're intended to burnish the reputation of politicians so they can show up for the announcement, they can show up for the groundbreaking, they can show up for the ribbon cutting, and they give the appearance that they're actually doing something.
But, Jim, are you really saying, though, that the governor doesn't want to have these jobs?
I'm sure he does, but that's not the objective. That would be a nice thing to happen, but it's all about the headline and giving the false appearance. Because if you really want to do something about the upstate economy, you'd have to do some pretty heavy lifting by way of legislation and regulation and things like that. And they're not interested in that because that's hard work. It's press releases and ribbon cuttings are not hard work.
What's the legislation that's needed?
Well, I mean, I think New York State's reputation for high taxes and regulation is pretty well established. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of it's good. We should not be Mississippi or Alabama. But there's a reasonableness that is sometimes lacking And it's the whole culture. It's the whole culture of the state. And changing culture is tough.
And would that not garner headlines, too? Trump is doing it nationally.
Well,
cut
he's
taxes,
doing something nationally.
cut taxes, cut regulations.
You know, foul the air and
the water
enrich
too.
The rich.
Water too. Yeah.
I actually had a question for you in terms of what type of jobs Cuomo is focused on creating. Are they tech-oriented? Are they more towards the more well-educated college or advanced degrees? Or is it, what kind of jobs does he prefer?
The Tesla jobs were supposed, when they were announced, they were going to be, you know, good-paying, you know, tech-type jobs.
Uh-huh.
The typical, you know, when you look at when they post job openings, they're $15, $16 an hour jobs.
I see.
IBM was supposed to be 500 high-tech software engineer jobs.
Okay, so there were...
It's a couple of hundred call center jobs.
Oh, boy.
And
wow.
And we did a series with ProPublica a couple of years back that looked at job growth during the Cuomo years. And the vast majority of job growth in upstate since he's taken office are low-wage jobs. We're losing high wage and we're gaining low wage. And that's one reason why upstate continues to be in the shape it's in. You know, if you lose a manufacturing job but you gain a part-time waitress, that's a wash, according to the
statistical analysis. Yeah.
But it's not.
It clearly is not for the community.
Now, you're a fearless guy. We know that. And then we know that that's why you're getting this award. And I have heard you say that when the people around Cuomo were either convicted or on the way to jail or in jail, that he should have gone too. He had to react to that, didn't he?
Well, during a trial a year and a half ago, I mean, it came out that the Cuomo people tried to target some of my large donors. Try and dissuade them.
Remembering that you're a not-for-profit corporation.
Yeah.
Could you give us an idea of the type of targeting?
Oh, just, you know, bad-mouthing type.
Okay.
You know, why are you supporting him?
No,
blah,
not a
blah,
threat,
blah.
Then.
Yeah, I mean,
implicit, maybe.
Well, that's what, yeah.
Yeah, state of New York versus helping out a small organization in Buffalo definitely is a threat.
Yeah, although, you know, as far as I can tell, you know, nobody backed off. I mean, my supporters are still my
supporters. They came
and
reported to what he was doing,
because
too.
People give me money because of what we do, not despite what we do. And, you know, those stories were very good reputation builders for us.
You can use that in fundraising. Does the governor return all your phone calls now?
So we'll take that as a no.
We have a few minutes before break, and I want to get this in. Can you just talk a little bit, Jim, about the role of investigative reporting in the state? And now, increasingly, we're seeing it nationally and internationally because it's under attack. You don't work for an established newspaper anymore. You have to start your own, and that's happening everywhere. Can you just talk a little bit about that? Do a commercial.
Well, investigative reporting at the national level, what the Times...
Underwritten, but go ahead.
You know, what the Times and the Post are doing, I think, has been absolutely critical to keeping people informed.
That's the Washington Post, by the way.
Yeah, Washington Post, New York Times. They're really exposing what's going on, which has a ripple effect in other media as well. On a local level, I think it's really critical because if you don't have the daily newspaper, no matter where you are, with the exception of the Washington Post and the New York Times, are employing fewer and fewer reporters. What you see as a trend is more sports, more entertainment, more coverage of events and press conferences.
Police blotter.
Yeah, because that's
easy stuff.
That's easy stuff. And what happens is, you know, you don't have investigative reporting to the same degree. I mean, you've still got it, but not to the same degree. I started Investigative Post because I recognized there was a niche in my market, and you know, we've done I think a pretty nice job of filling part of the niche. But I'm a 4-person operation. That doesn't replace, you know, the Buffalo News in its heyday was 225 people. Now it's fewer than 100.
And the Poughkeepsie Journal used to do wonderful investigative work, less so now because there are fewer people.
Yeah, so it, you know, what's happening is you've got less investigative reporting going on, and you've got greater contempt on the part of government officials to the public's right to know. And you really have to be persistent in order to break through.
Did you have?
No, I just wanted to signal we had 1 minute.
Oh, no, yeah, oh, yeah. So my question is, what you worked with the Buffalo Post. What kind of, so what work are they doing?
And
what
Buffalo are, News.
Buffalo News, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Actually, the News of late's done some really good work around sex abuse of children by Catholic clergy.
Yeah.
They've done some really, really good work. They've done some work on anti-poverty agencies that seem to be, you know, taking care of themselves rather than the people they're supposed to be serving. You know, the kind of work we've done, I mean, we've done a lot on corruption with the Buffalo Billion. Buffalo, much like, I think, even Albany, you know, Buffalo has a serious lead poisoning problem, and we've been banging away at that for a couple of years, lead poisoning of inner city kids. Mm-hmm. We've done some work over the last year over our local off-track betting corporation, which is just a cesspool.
Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about other stuff around the world, and Jim Heaney is here, and we're very grateful. Alan, Vera, and Rosemary as well, we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC. We will continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion, Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Vera Carias-Kelly, and our special guest, Jim Heaney, this morning. So let us talk. We've been talking about Jim's work, and so let's go to the regular stories of the day, and let's talk about the Attorney General, William Barr. President Trump wanted Barr to hold a news conference declaring that the commander-in-chief had broken no laws during a phone call in which he pressed his Ukrainian counterpart to investigate a political rival, though Barr ultimately declined to do so. The request from Trump traveled from the president to other White House officials and eventually to the Justice Department. The president has mentioned Barr's demurral to associates in recent weeks, saying he wished Barr would have held the news conference. In recent weeks, the Justice Department has sought some distance from the White House, particularly on matters relating to the burgeoning controversy over Trump's dealings on Ukraine and the impeachment inquiry they sparked. People close to the administration say Barr and Trump remain on good terms. A senior administration official said Trump praised the attorney general publicly and privately Wednesday, and Deputy House Press Secretary Hogan Gidley said in a statement the president has nothing but respect for Barr and greatly appreciates
the work
he's done.
He's in trouble. He's in trouble.
I was going to say that, too.
So, those close to the administration also concede that the department has made several recent maneuvers, putting it at odds with the White House at a particularly precarious time for the president. Like others, they spoke on the condition of anonymity, so they wouldn't get in trouble.
It's fascinating. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I'll start. I think Terry Gibson laid it out for us on an earlier program when he said Barr should be the communications director. He's running the real PR that works for Trump, not the silliness we're getting from Grisham and that we got earlier from Saunders. And he probably, the reason he's in good stead still, said, look, no, now is not the time for a news conference. Let me help you when I really can. And he already tried to. He tried to squash that whistleblower complaint. I want to know how that whistleblower complaint ended on the chairs of all those congressmen. It must have been. Mm-hmm. But he had already worked then to stop that, to not send it to the FBI, to make sure it didn't turn into an investigation. And he'll do it later. He'll spin it when it comes out of the, when it comes out of the impeachment proceedings. He'll do another Barr thing saying this doesn't mean anything, this is why it's bad. And that worked. And it also must be very galling for Barr to be listening to the constant news chatter and opinion pieces about what a bad job he's doing, how he's subsumed by Trump. That's got to be jarring to him as well.
My question, my immediate reaction to reading the article was, so was this ultimately then what Mulvaney did?
What do you mean?
Meaning when Mulvaney went out and did the press conference? When he was announcing and started to do, was that ultimately what he wanted?
The Mulvaney press conference was actually to announce that
the G7
the conference was going to be at the Doral. And that was just supposed to be, okay, I'll take some questions on this. And then he mucked it up.
Well,
so
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, I was just thinking the idea alone that the Attorney General is treated and may have behaved to some extent as if he was the Trump family's private attorney is utterly disturbing and shows a pattern that we have seen with Sessions before. And when you said, oh, he's in trouble, I think, you know, the release of this article today, the investigative journalism, our conversation, lots of media coverage of this particular issue will actually endanger Barr as a long-serving attorney general in the Trump administration, because I think he's actually trying to create a little bit of distance. And by not going out and following the wishes of Trump and now having it discussed in the media is something that will probably reverberate today and tomorrow in the White House and get Barr in a more precarious situation, is my guess.
Not only that, but today is an interesting day in that Sessions is announcing that he's running for his old Senate seat, which, of course, has got to be a bit of an embarrassment in the same time that if the president intends to go after Barr, which I agree with you, I think he inevitably will.
It's a matter of time, right?
Yeah. Well,
interesting part there is that Sessions could win easily, and that's got to be an attraction to McConnell, who wants to keep control. So it sets up a dispute between McConnell and Trump if Trump blocks it.
I think, though, that when I said he's in trouble, I was kind of joking, because at least a rational person would say to himself, I've got an attorney general who is basically my personal attorney.
My guy.
Why? I'm not going to find anybody else who's going to prostitute himself and damage his reputation the way I've got with the guy I got right now. So he's not doing everything I want him to, but there's nobody else who's going to do half of what he's going to do. So I think that may be his salvation.
And one other issue, of course, Jim, and that is, what does Barr know? How much does Barr know that could be a potential embarrassment?
He's got to know a lot.
Yes.
I see the logic of that, but I don't think Trump thinks like a normal, rational
person. Well, I preface it by saying a normal, rational person would approach it that
He'll
way.
Put Jay Sekulow in as acting attorney general, and Sekulow will do anything for him. So, and he thinks he's right. So I'm not sure he thinks that way. My thinking is more how Barr is maneuvering this. Barr, I think, wants to stay there. He has a lifetime goal of promoting the power of the presidency. He has an opportunity to do this now and wants to continue it. So I think he's manipulating Trump, flattering, saying, hey, here's a better strategy. We'll do it your way. I'm totally with you. That's how I see it.
And yet, look, Rosemary, as much as I admire and respect everything you say, look at the way in which Barr is playing this. To some degree, Barr and the New York Times is playing this. To some degree, they're setting up, you know, this confrontation between the two people so that if Trump gets into real trouble, Barr will be in a position to sort of say, hey, don't look at me.
Well, it might be, but I suspect he's in the Oval Office saying, look, I've got to maintain this idea that I'm independent. So I'm going to go and say, hey, we have nothing to do with Rudy's deal in Ukraine. I think Rudy's going to definitely be thrown under the bus, and he'll take the blame for both Barr and Trump.
Your mouth to God's ear.
So when it comes to this particular story, I mean, what is it ultimately, the idea of going out and saying, okay, I want you to say these things that aren't true.
Then, and the Times says no. He said no, I won't
do
that.
Yes. They said he demurred.
This time he
won't do that. Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I agree
But my question is, so we assume then that, but the message still got out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're finding out that by him saying no, that he must have seen some writing on the wall, yes?
No, well, I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. I mean, this is not a president who suffers anybody taking any dissident line. And of course, while all the newspaper people in the room will disagree with me, the Times has had its own agenda, I think a progressive and a good agenda, and I think they see an opportunity here to drive that wedge further.
No, I don't think they have an. I think they go after anybody in power, any president they're going to go after, and they have, and their record's clear on that. Trump does seem to invite it, though.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have more stories to go over. We'll welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Jim Heaney, Vera Carias-Kelly, and Rosemary Armeo, we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we welcome your letters again. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. I'm telling Sarah this through the radio because if she is sending me mail, I'm not getting it because I don't know that I'm getting email. So
yeah,
maybe we
right.
can print that out today. I'm not sure. Because I've written to her,
it's
but I don't think she got that either.
Yes. Somebody is trying to mess with us.
I think so.
Probably.
All right. So let's move on to another issue, and then we'll hopefully catch up on the letters. So the top American diplomat in Ukraine, who is to be the first witness in public House impeachment hearings, told investigators it was Rudolph Giuliani who instigated the Ukraine pressure campaign. Speaking of completely disappeared, where did he go?
Giuliani, he's enjoying a spa visit right now because he's preparing himself what's to come. He'll be under the bus in no time.
Does he have a lawyer yet? He was having trouble signing up somebody.
And I love the way that they put his picture up on the TV all the time, in which he appears to be a braying jackass, if you can say that word.
I think you just did, and I think you can.
Yeah, it's your station, right?
Not mine.
He has gotten himself into some trouble. I don't know how to get around that. He's under investigation. And Barr, by the way, is privy to anything that the Southern District is collecting on him, mm-hmm. which may also be playing into this. And I think he's being set up as the... That's my working hypothesis, scapegoat for all this.
Do you think there is a dissonance between Barr and his people at the Southern District? It seems that there are times
absolutely.
Yeah, that they are
absolutely.
Not happy with
them. There's a lack of trust and possibly a willingness to actually exchange open thoughts and ideas because the Southern District appears to completely disagree with what's going on under Barr's leadership.
But Trump holds all Barr holds all the power there. He can just simply dismiss the attorney and stop the investigation. The problem, of course, is that's a political issue if he does it.
Yep. Sure. And then there will be people that speak up and sort of clarify publicly what Barr has been involved in. He might be a little concerned about that, too, because that's his public reputation.
Right. What is the so right now when it comes to where Giuliani is and the information that comes? So what do they do next? I mean, obviously they're probably not going to get him, right?
Get Giuliani?
Meaning getting him to testify.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, they can get him on calls, all kinds of things like not having declared this, not having filed FARA papers initially and inquiring about that and then who he collaborated with, which lobby firm he was affiliated with, what kind of foreign governments he's worked with, what kind of relationship he has forged abroad, and then they keep mm-hmm. going and keep going. I mean, his future looks cloudy at best.
That is a brilliant recitation, Vera. I have to say that of what's up here because I think a lot of people know that Giuliani has been playing his own role in terms of our foreign policy, but they don't remember who he was working for mm-hmm. privately while that was going on.
Yeah, well, his finances are very much under scrutiny right now, as the stories are pointing out, and they're mm-hmm. looking at who is paying him and what exactly was his connection to the State Department. We don't know that right now. He boasted. Do you remember Fox mm-hmm. News ran an interview with him where he held up his phone and said, "It's all right here. Everything I did was at the behest of the State Department." So that plays into the impeachment inquiry, too.
Yeah, we know it was not on behest of the State Department, as a matter of fact. Otherwise, we wouldn't see all these State Department officials speak up at this impeachment, the impending public hearings as well. I mean, they're pretty straight up on that.
Yeah, but that's Pompeo. Pompeo was above all of them, and he did what Trump wanted.
Yeah, well, Pompeo's reputation obviously is, soiled as well, and he will have a hard time remaining a credible representative within the U.S. government. But I think there are all these Giuliani linkages. Let me just say it this way. the slime is rising, and Giuliani is about to be the slime that rises to the very top, because he has linkages to all these people, all these lobby firms, and he has worked with unsavory characters in various foreign countries, and this will all be laid out and nicely mapped out in newspapers, and they will explain it to the public.
I think Pompeo and Sessions are going to end back up in the Senate, and they'll be just fine.
Aren't you cheerful today, Rosemary?
I'm never cheerful. I know. There's big support for all of what's going on,
yes.
And too many of my countrymen do not see this as either serious or important.
Much more important is an economy. I have trust in the American public.
I believe people
are smart. They will pay close attention once the public hearings begin, and they're also intrigued by how these kinds of connections have emerged. And it's like a puzzle. And it is a little complicated, but it will be nicely laid out by numerous journalists that do investigative work. And I think that will be incredibly important.
I'm afraid
tell them about all the times you write stories, and immediately there's a public response, and then the lawmakers do what they're supposed to.
See, I think the problem is that it doesn't matter what comes out. People have made up their minds.
One way or the other.
They just, either he's terrible and he should be impeached, or he's just a victim of a witch hunt. And I think the people that are genuinely curious and persuadable is a pretty small sliver of the
electorate. An important sliver.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's an important sliver, and I think we have seen a shift within, for example, women voters, because they're simply tired of language use and sort of, gender-based discriminatory patterns. I think we see it within African-American communities, Latino communities. I see it within young people at Siena College who have shifted and asked very interesting questions. A lot of students sort of found Trump interesting and engaging. Now they find him really disturbing, because mostly environmental issues, lack of regulation, lack of understanding for what the challenges are ahead for young people. I see a shift happening slowly, but it is happening.
The election's November 2020, I remind you. We're talking culture change. You're talking big movements, and I don't see it happening in time.
And the Democrats are not helping because
who's the big hero saying, yeah, I'm going to put my support behind that person who represents what I stand for? Not happening. AOC has to gain a few more years. She can't even run yet. Then we'll talk.
You're saying.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm a little more hopeful. People out there, I believe change is possible. I think I see patterns of that.
The shift has already occurred. It occurred starting the day of inauguration. It started before then. I mean, I think the vast majority of Americans have made up their mind. I mean, they can hold the election now, and it's not going to be any different than what it's going to be a year from now.
I disagree, because we will see also some economic consequences of what's going on right now in the next sort of 8 months. I believe we will see negative consequences on sort of manufacturing in this country, further impact on farming communities. I believe there's an entire segment of the population beginning to intensively feel the negative consequences of international trade.
Well, not according to the New York Times.
Or to Aaron, on the panel, spoke about this last Friday.
Who seems to think that is, the Democrats are in an interesting position in which, unfortunately, some of them are wishing that the economy goes south and predicting that the economy goes south in order to defeat Trump. Mm-hmm. But so far, the 401ks and stuff aren't showing that.
But you know what? Not everybody has 401ks in this country. There are a lot of people in manufacturing, in the automobile industry that's slowing down, in coal, which never came back as promised.
And yet, when you see CNN, they go around and they interview all these people in the Trump states, and they have terrible things.
Aaron, our own economist at your school spoke, and that was really interesting. He goes, the signs are looking bad. What we're seeing is a slowing of the increase in growth. That is not the same as a depression. That is not going to shock anybody. That's like, well, he's trying, he's working, you know, and those damned Democrats are obstructing everything, but he's really trying. Look at this. These are quotes from letters that we get here from Trump supporters. His trade deals are flowing. What? That's what they say. And he's trying. And coal, he's working against, you know, a big trend against it, but he's still trying. He still has our back. He's a scumbag, but he's still doing good things. My cousin's pronouncement, which represents the view.
Well, but as you mentioned, the election isn't until November 2020. I think some of the consequences of international trade deals will be felt more.
Vera, you know that this president is sitting there in the White House and saying, before we get to 2020, I'll make sure we're okay with China. In other words, he'll do what he has to do.
You cannot turn things around with China within months. This is a years-long consequence. The next 5 years, 10 years, we'll feel the consequence.
Vera, see how he works. All he has to do is make an announcement.
That's all.
He needs the news conference saying, we have a deal with China. You are going to see amazing things in the next 6 months. And people go, yeah. The stock market already reacts.
It does, every time he goes to
the G7 and says, we're talking, talks are back on. What did the stock market do? You have a lovely, hopeful attitude. I hope you are right, but I just don't see any evidence of it. I couldn't print it.
So I want to go to the letters in a second, but real quick, we did learn yesterday, Adam Schiff announced that there will be two public hearings next week. We are going to, no high-fiving in the studio. We are going to hear from U.S. diplomat Bill Taylor and State Department official George Kent will appear next Wednesday. And former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, is testifying next Friday. Public hearings, what do you expect?
So the question is, are we going to hear anything that we haven't heard already?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, it seems like a lot of the most important stuff's already made its way onto television and in the pages of newspapers. Yeah.
Yeah. So here are the two things I'm looking for. No leaks have come from the Republican side. Is that because there's nothing in there? There's nothing that that points to, okay, maybe the Trump side had a point. That will be interesting. And then there are the small details that I keep coming out. That the big points are out, but those little points are also really, really telling. For me, one of them was when I can never remember her name, the ambassador.
Yovanovitch.
Yes, when she was pushed back, they said to her, get on the next plane. And she's saying, what? And they go, yeah, security violation. She was in fear. That's a little detail we didn't know before. This is so cruel.
We knew that before. It was leaked. I knew that. I knew that she publicly stated that she was afraid for her safety. This is a behavior of a criminal organized gang against our own State Department diplomats at the highest level. It is disturbing and disgusting.
And also we know that the counsels, the lawyers for both sides will be asking very pointed questions now, which hasn't happened until now. It's been the Congress folks showing off up until now. So we may get some different testimony, but one can only wonder. Do you want some letters, Joe, or not?
We have 2 minutes.
Okay, here we go. I'll keep them fast. Jeremy, Barr's story is very odd. Something stinks about the Attorney General press conference story. Barr just got back from a tour of Europe where he publicly chased down Trump's politically motivated conspiracy theories. Why would he suddenly grow a spine when it comes to the Ukraine story? Jeremy from Hurley, New York, where everybody keeps it down. And Frank said, suburban Philly turns blue. Hello, panel. Here's an interesting omen for 2020 from Philadelphia's western suburbs. In Tuesday's elections, Democrats took all 5 Delaware County Council seats for the first time since the Civil War. Trump won Pennsylvania's 20 electoral votes by less than 1% in 2016. Is the Keystone State now poised to turn blue? Well, let me just say to you, according to the New York Times, and at least the last thing I read there, he has a very good chance of winning again in exactly where he won the last time. So that's fascinating.
Well, maybe or maybe not. I don't know that we really have all the information that we always. I think we're so afraid of another 4 years that we no longer see the signals, the changes on the grassroots level. I'm confident.
Possible.
There will be change.
No, it's possible. You mean the New York Times can be wrong?
Could that be possible?
Okay, so here we go. Last letter that I have to read. Martin Durham and Horowitz reports, "Hello, Roundtable Panel, streaming your show in Quebec daily. Nice. I have far-right conservative friends who continue to warn me, almost threateningly, of the impending Inspector General's report concerning the Russia probe. What are the likely outcomes and impacts?"
Well, it's going to depend on
Jim, you're our guest. Take it.
Yeah. You know, it's, again, when it comes to everything around Trump, people are going to not so much pay attention to the particular new news. They've already made their minds up. And, you know, I mean,
I agree with that.
There's a certain amount, speaking personally, there's a certain amount of fatigue.
Speaking personally, and just because I'm taking a poll of the room, but do you believe we're doomed?
Oh, you know, no. My vote.
The country?
Yeah.
In other words, will Trump win re-election or we don't?
You know, I told people 3 years ago there's no way he's going to get elected to begin with.
And
he did. But I will say it's unlikely he will get re-elected because he barely squeaked by last time. And he has done nothing to expand his base.
Correct.
I think he's done things to build a base for whoever is going to be running against him on the Democratic line. So, but, you know, there's really 50 different elections going on next year.
Correct.
And, you know, you need to get to that magic number. And so, you know.
All right. With that, we'll take a break. We'll get news from Ray Graff, and we'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us, Alan Chartok, Jim Heaney, Vera Carius Kelly, and Rosemary Armeo. We have letters still, Alan, yes?
We do.
All right.
Thank you for asking, Joe. RJ said, "Understanding Barr's goals. I've heard it said that Attorney General Barr supports Trump in part because he believes the president should have more, most, all of the power compared with the legislature and the judicial branches in line with the theory of the unitary executive?" My question is, why would Barr or others like him so want the president to have essentially unchecked power? Related question, I also suspect understand that Barr likes, in quotes, Trump, because Trump somehow supports Barr's extreme Catholic, in quotes, goals. My question about this is, how capitalized does Trump further Barr's religious goals?
All right.
All right. Well, says Joe, that means move on. Frank says, Giuliani, hello, panel. A New York Times article yesterday did a story on how Rudy is having a hard time finding representation in law firms and staying away from him. Also, thanks for having a new guest panelist today. You should really do more of that often to enhance the great regulars you have on the panel. Frank from Middletown.
Do I get a raise?
Yeah. John
just
says,
like all of us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's free coffee. John says, A.G. Barr. Dear panel, while A.G. Barr did decline to hold a press conference, keep in mind that the justice did release a statement along with the original whistleblower news stating its criminal division had reviewed the transcript and found no campaign-financed law violations or other criminal acts. Best, John, J-O-N.
Can I just remind everybody that it's not an actual transcript of the phone call, but it's a written-up document based on notes and memory. So it is not the official transcript of the phone call, which we may still see.
Hi, panel.
Hi.
Says, and this is about Giuliani. One question I've not found an answer for yet anywhere. Is it possible for someone representing U.S. foreign policy to get paid by the president as a private citizen rather than from the State Department budget? Shouldn't that be a clear indication whether he was representing the government or Trump's private interests? Keep up the great work, and that's from Kathleen.
Yes.
Now, I hate to say this, and Vera, you'll...
Oh, I'm already feeling like I'm going to disagree with you.
Yeah, I think you are. FDR really didn't like his State Department. He did not.
Mm-hmm.
And history shows that. And
Joe Kennedy shouldn't have liked it.
What'd you say?
It was Joe Kennedy. Well, he shouldn't have liked it.
But it wasn't only Joe Kennedy. It was he thought there were a bunch of stiffs. So he had his own people. He dispatched them, and they did the work for him. So, and I'm not defending Trump here because I think the Giuliani thing is a mess and disgusting.
Yes,
but nevertheless, yep. There is precedent.
There is a difference that I'd like to point out in the way that, for example, President Clinton relied, and several presidents actually relied on Bill Richardson as a special envoy to do particular things in terms of getting hostages out of North Korea. Those are possibilities if you are public about hiring on an official to carry out a particular international or foreign policy issue or mission. It is, however, not acceptable to secretly have a shadow foreign policy carried out by a Giuliani and then engage in organized crime type activity and pressure in a foreign government. That is not something that prior president.
It wasn't secret. That's democratic language. He openly told everybody in the State Department, talk to Rudy about that. It was open.
Except for it was not publicly announced that Rudy was engaging in such activity before Rudy went.
Show me the law where it says you have to do that. The president has such wide discretion in foreign policy, he's going to get away with it. It's fine.
Well, I'm just pointing out there's no precedent for this kind of behavior, and therefore we should question it and investigate beyond the things we already know and look at the criminal activity that Giuliani is involved in. And as basic as not filing FARA documentation is an act against U.S. law.
And as I used to say,
or if we're in his base, we say, yay, here's the man who wipes away all those precedents that befouled years of effete American
foreign
policy.
Are you on somebody's payroll
I'm trying to tell you.
Are you having a bad day?
and yet, as I have said to my children when they were growing up, they're all grown up now, I used to say to them, you're both right. Okay, so Rosemary's right. Americans don't pay attention. Hello, panel. Rosemary is right. We may not be doomed, but the American people do not pay attention to anything. Why would people pay attention to impeachment hearings on C-SPAN versus the 24-hour day coverage and ads and the rest that are occupied during the 2016 election? People paid attention, and they voted for Hillary. But it shows that she is not president. I have no faith in the majority of Americans, sadly, as most people cannot name their representative, let alone the Supreme Court justices. Very sad state of affairs. Thank you from Christopher. And, you know, Jim, as a guy who blows the whistle on so many things here, there's some truth to that, right? I mean, you do it. It's like a pebble falling in the pond.
Well, I think people are paying attention to Trump in general. Are they paying attention to every little twist and turn? No, because it's like a tidal wave. It just keeps coming and coming and coming.
Which he does on purpose, of course. It's a distraction.
Well, it's not just, I mean, you know, I stopped watching cable news because it's the same
show after
stuff.
Show.
Uh-huh. It's the same
panel.
Shouting talking heads.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I never watch Fox. But I can't stand CNN or MSNBC.
It's like a repeat of the night
before. It's predictable.
Yeah.
And you know, people like Chris Cuomo, I mean, they're not, I call them, they're news actors. They're really not journalists. My wife and I sometimes argue because she'll sometimes watch it and I'm like, I'm not putting that crap in my head because it's all entertainment.
My wife too.
I took a break last night and watched Mayberry with my mother. It was great.
Yeah.
But you know, I have to say, I go back to written journalistic reporting, especially also international. I think there's a lot that we can get from newspapers also from, you know, published in the UK, in Europe. I find a lot of interesting information in more detail and more thoughtfully discussed. As you mentioned, we have, you know, investigative journalists in this country who write superb and detailed accounts of what is going on. I think you have to read these days instead of watch Politico entertainment.
I don't want to... I don't want to in any way alienate you because you're such
really?
A vicious part, a
it's
wonderful
part. It's a dangerous path to be on, Alan.
No, but I too read.
And away we go.
I too read the British press, for example.
Yes.
I go there all the time to see, and I'm always disappointed.
Really?
Because we have built up this idea that somehow British journalism is better and more detailed than American journalism. And yet, when I read the stuff, it isn't really profound.
Well, it is profound when you look at international news and then look at some of the U.S. foreign policy implications in the Middle East, for
then
example.
Then what sources are you looking at? Because I agree with Alan. Yeah. I look for in-depth, deep dives in foreign press, and I often find it difficult to find.
So I find, for example, The Guardian has some really interesting articles on a regular basis. Maybe if I find a really good one, I'll forward it to
it's
you.
The, first, it's
the Guardian has terrific investigative reporting.
We have The Guardian articles here sometimes, but they're not. Go ahead.
The British press has been harder hit even than the American press by economic factors. And the laws in England are the libel laws, especially, are horrible. That's what Trump wants to do here. They have that in Britain. And that is a chilling effect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, another note from Barbara. Pessimism or realism? Unfortunately, I am with Rosemary on the general outlook. I am appalled with the ignorance and apathy of the American people. I'm just being realistic. I don't think there's much hope for us on many fronts, societal, environmental, etc. And that's Barbara from New Milford, Connecticut, where I went to Bucks Rock Work Camp.
Well, Barbara, thank you for your note. However, I am still optimistic because I work at a college campus and I see younger generations emerge and talk about the change they want. So I just want to make sure that we don't just assume because we're in a certain age range that we are simply thinking that is the only people that are caring about politics. I think we are seeing the emergence of a new civically engaged youth movement. And I'm going to say that again and again. I believe 10 years from now, you will realize the kind of rage that is emerging among young people.
Rosemary?
Right now.
I remember the 70s. It's the same thing, and it didn't happen. And I hope you're right. I think for me, seeing young people both here and in the Middle East did not encourage my optimism.
Well,
and Barbara, I'll meet you halfway between Albany and your place, and we'll drink up to this.
So can I just say on the Middle East, watch what's going on in the Middle East. Look at Iraq. Hundreds of young people have been shot dead by Iranian snipers, and they're coming to the streets, and they're protesting, and they're shutting down Karbala. And you see what's going on internationally with the protests on the Kurds. And look at Chile. And look at Lebanon. We are seeing an international movement of people simply expressing how sick and tired they are of corruptive practices, of elites in government who are inconsiderate of the needs and the future economic requests of young people. I think we're seeing the beginning of an international movement towards shifting governments to be much more responsible
to
citizenry.
And you see that here too? You see that here too?
I see that emerging here. I see it emerging when it comes to environmental issues.
Okay, so I just want to report, because this is radio, that when you began to speak, Rosemary was making a face.
No, I'm not. I'm suppressing my lips together so I do not interrupt. I have a problem with that, as you know.
I have it, too. So anyway, Becky.
Am I the only well-mannered person in this room?
You are.
You might be.
I've never been accused of that before.
You and Joe.
Well, I think Joe is probably winning that award.
Over to Joe.
Well, okay, so we got about 5 minutes left, so let's finish up. The two things I want to talk about, well, we mentioned Jeff Sessions running for Alabama.
Yeah.
Who said he will win easily?
I do.
Yeah, you think he'll win easily.
I think he'll trump anybody who's out there. And it's getting to be a pretty crowded field. There's Doug Jones, of course, the Democrat. There's Moore, the pederast who wants to run again. And there's two other more reputable Republicans who have all jumped in. But he's got name recognition, 22 years of experience, lots of ties, the same philosophy as Alabama. I can't see him losing.
Well,
he also
if I may, just for 1 second. And that is the other side to that, Rosemary, is the one thing he doesn't have is Trump.
Right.
Yeah.
And there are those people who think that the Alabamians are more committed to Trump than they are to Sessions. who they see as potential enemies with each other.
But Sessions, you understand, also loves Trump. And the one area of disagreement was he felt he had to recuse himself. So I think that's something he can say to his people. I hated to do it. I didn't want to do it. I had to. Everyone says I did. You know, I would be in jail if I didn't. And I still supported the president. I never abandoned him. I only left when he forced me to. That's pretty powerful.
That's pretty far down in the weeds, however, in terms of people's understanding of how all this works. To me, it's do I love Trump or do I love Sessions, and do I perceive them as enemies? And if I do, then what do I do?
So one of the things that I'm thinking about is if there is, you know, a direct attack by Trump on Sessions, if that actually manifests itself in a real campaign. What about issues of the past that Sessions might have to deal with? Calling the NAACP or ACLU
that ain't gonna help
American,
him in his state.
You know. So I'm making jokes that he later claims were jokes, calling the KKK likable until he found out that some of them were also smoking pot and things like that.
That's, you know, not going to hurt him in Alabama.
I think it might among us. You know, we assume
among the,
that states,
the young people who are going to change everything.
I think that we assume
sardonic,
that the voters
right?
remain always the same. Please take a look at Kentucky. Now, I know Alabama is more conservative
0.4%.
Than Kentucky.
0.4%.
But
name recognition
look
alone.
At change within. I think I'm just not willing to accept that, you know, certain states never change. The opinions of people are always sort of rigidly, almost genetically predisposed to voting for certain people.
But,
I think that's not true.
But with the exception of that governor who everybody hated, and when Trump came in, he came up to within 0.4%. Every other office holder, virtually, Republican won in Kentucky. So things didn't change.
No, they haven't changed very quickly. And, I mean, Trump lost in Alabama when he backed possibly the worst candidate to ever run anywhere, any place. And that was pretty much a squeaker as well. So, no, I don't see
Well,
your
I'm
cause
hopeful
of hope.
That we will see change over time. It might not happen fast enough in some of the states, but I do see change agents
well, Vera, 2020
in all
is coming
of
up.
These kinds of states. But, you know, I think we're mostly concerned about Pennsylvania and Michigan, maybe
Wisconsin.
Iowa, Wisconsin. Those are the kinds of places we're concerned about for 2020. Not so much the immediate changes that we need to, you know, we don't need to see immediate changes in Kentucky or Alabama, but we will see some of those changes as well.
All right, we are out of time. My thanks to everybody. Jim Heaney, you are going to be receiving the Nellie Bly Award, and that is tonight. And we thank you very much for being with us. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you for being with us.
And an honest broker.
Alan, Jim, Vera, Rosemary, thank you all very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.